You're listening to A Closer Look. I'm Rose Scott alongside Dennis O'Hare. This week, the U.S. Supreme Court agreed to hear the case of Timothy Foster. He's a Georgia death row inmate. Foster was sentenced to die for the 1987 murder of a 79-year-old woman, Queen Madge White. And when the U.S. Supreme Court takes up the case, they will look at whether prosecutors racially discriminated in the jury selection process.
Now, the jury in the Foster case was made up of all white members, and the prosecutor's notes show the names of prospective black jurors were highlighted with the word black circled. Sarah Turberville is a senior counsel with the Nonpartisan Constitution Project, which studies death penalty cases like these, and she joins us now. Ms. Turberville, thanks for taking the time. We appreciate it.
Thank you for asking me to join you.
Okay, an overall view first, and we'll probably need the Cliff Notes version of this, but there was a 1986 Supreme Court decision called Batson. People who watch Law & Order hear that thrown around quite a bit. It was aimed at ending racial discrimination in jury selection. But are there any clear guidelines for defense attorneys and prosecutors on what are and what or are not what one might call race-neutral reasons for striking a prospective juror? Did the court give you any guidance at all?
In Batson v. Kentucky, there wasn't a great deal of guidance on what would sort of be a permissible race-neutral explanation for striking members of the jury who are African-American or people of color, or striking individuals on the basis of their gender. What Batson did was set out a kind of procedure that courts could follow in determining if there was purposeful discrimination. And of course, purposeful discrimination on the basis of race is prohibited by the 14th Amendment. So that would be the constitutional issue that we're looking at here in jury selection.
Yeah, and the 14th Amendment is equal protection under the law. So why is this one coming to the Supreme Court now?
Sure. Well, Mr. Foster's case, as you described, he was tried, I believe, in 1989. And at that trial, his defense counsel actually objected to the prosecution's use of what are called peremptory strikes, which are meaning that the prosecution and defense counsel can use sort of, you know, they have a number of kind of optional strikes that they can use to remove individuals who they don't think will be kind of favorable to their party's view during the at the trial.
And real quickly, does a peremptory strike mean they can just strike you and they don't have to tell you why? Is that it?
That's right.
Yeah. Okay.
So what happened in Mr. Foster's case is that there were five African Americans who were summoned in the entire, who constituted the entire population of people of color in the jury pool in his case. And four of them were removed via peremptory strike. One was removed for cause, which is basically somebody who has maybe a conflict of interest in the case or something like that. And so 100% of the people of color were removed from Mr. Foster's jury pool. And at that point, the defense counsel raised an objection stating that this is a violation of Batson v. Kentucky. The court found that the defense counsel had made a facial showing of that kind of discrimination, and then the burden then shifts under Batson to the prosecution to offer a race-neutral explanation for the use of a peremptory strike under these circumstances. And in this instance, a handful of different explanations were provided by the prosecution. Things like this person is too young to serve. For one juror, they said that she worked with low-income, underprivileged children, and so for that reason, she might be sort of hostile to the prosecution's case or something like that.
Yeah,
and
she worked, I think in the one of the issues was that she worked with kids from the projects, and Mr. Foster likely could have been one of those children that she or family members could have worked with. When you hear these types of explanations, and we're hearing that the prosecutors don't really have to say why they don't want a certain juror on, but is there a legal justification that they need to adhere to? Because when you look at the notes, and I don't know if you had time to go over the notes, mm-hmm. it seems pretty clear that they were trying to exclude people of color.
Well, what the trial court at Mr. Foster's actual trial didn't have the benefit of is this trove of information that we now have that contains all of the prosecutor's notes during jury selection. So when the trial court judge back in 1989 overruled defense counsel and said that there was not purposeful discrimination, they didn't have all these notes that were released in 2006 via a Georgia Open Records request that indicated, that had the name of each black prospective juror highlighted in green in all four copies of the jury list that the prosecution had, that had the word black circled next to the race question on the juror questionnaires, had identified different jurors as B number one, B number two, B number three, had ranked black prospective jurors against each other, stating that if it comes down to having to pick one of the black jurors, we would, want to go for this one. So when Mr. Foster made his first appeal after he was convicted and sentenced to death by an all-white jury, he again raised the Batson claims. But during that appeal, the prosecution refused to disclose, and the court did not require them to disclose the prosecution's notes from trial. And so it was only in 2006 that this new evidence came to light.
We're speaking with Sarah Turberville. She's a senior counsel with the Nonpartisan Constitution Project, which studies death penalty cases like the one we're talking about involving Timothy Foster. Let me get your thoughts on this. If a defense attorney suspects there's racial discrimination in the selection process, in your mind, does he or she have an obligation to then object at the time if they suspect that?
Absolutely. And in fact, it is the duty of any competent defense counsel to object. And this is because if defense counsel fails to object at trial, then the defendant is going to be procedurally barred from raising this issue on appeal. And so in Mr. Foster's case, he was kind of lucky in a way that his defense counsel did continue to raise the Batson issue at his trial.
But in this case, when it went to the state Supreme Court, this is back in 1988 now, when the state Supreme Court first heard the appeal, didn't they find that jurors were excluded for other reasons, like opposition to the death penalty, for instance? In other words, just because someone was highlighted by race, does that mean that was the eventual reason they were excluded?
Well, according to when I looked at the petition for Mr. Foster that was filed with the Supreme Court, the prospective jurors were not actually, they weren't questioned on any of the bases that the prosecution raised as reasons for excluding them. To my knowledge, questions about their ability to possibly impose a death sentence were not actually, that's not what we're looking at here, because that would be a reason to remove a juror for cause. What we're looking at here are the use of the peremptory strikes.
And the other issue that's been raised is that during closing arguments, one of the prosecutors said something like the jury needed to send a message to the projects, which in that area of Rome, Georgia, were overwhelmingly African American, and that was a reason for highlighting for finding racial discrimination. But even if racial discrimination is identified, does the convicted person still have to prove that discrimination made a significant difference in the outcome of his or her case? Is that part of what the Supreme Court will be looking at?
No, in this instance, under Batson, it's that if there was purposeful discrimination, then that is a violation of the constitutional rights of the defendant. And as a result, he would be entitled to a new trial that is conducted to comport with the requirements of our Constitution.
So the state could not argue, the evidence overwhelmingly showed he was guilty no matter what misconduct might have occurred.
Absolutely, because what would happen is that it all comes down to the decision of the jury. And so it's not possible sort of to predict that it doesn't matter which juror would have been on the jury, that he would have been convicted, because ultimately the jury is the fact finder, and the jury is the entity that determines the sentence in death penalty cases in Georgia.
Well, with the discovery of the notes, and if it appears to many in the legal community and even to you, if discrimination is so clear in this case based on the notes, does it sort of say something about the court system here in Georgia not being able to see that, even with the admittance of all these notes from the prosecutors? It just seems like it's a no-brainer in a sense.
Well, there's a great deal of deference that post-conviction courts have for the original findings of a trial court. And so in this instance, you know, the state habeas court even referenced the original trial court's finding. Now, it is a bit nonsensical, right, because now we've got a huge trove of information about what was going on behind the scenes with the prosecution and jury selection that wasn't available at the original trial. In addition to that, the Georgia Supreme Court, elected not to review the state habeas court's decision, and that's what sort of left Mr. Foster to make an appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court. And he's clearly gotten the attention of at least four justices here in Washington on that basis. Yeah. So, I think it is certainly disconcerting that this kind of what seems to be definitive and rather concrete evidence of purposeful discrimination was not sufficient to make a difference to the state habeas court.
And as we wrap up, that leads me to the final question: is that, you know, a lot of people in the legal community were really surprised that the Supreme Court did agree to hear this. I mean, we're talking about a case that's almost 30 mm-hmm. years old here.
Mm-hmm. Well, the case is 30 years old, but the new evidence that came to light is less than a decade old. And I think that, you know, we've seen a number of cases that the Supreme Court has decided to hear related to the death penalty. I think the court is becoming increasingly concerned with problems of procedural justice and substantive justice as well in some of these cases.
And quickly, and I apologize for interrupting. Sure. We're out of time. I want a quick yes or no on this one, if you can. Are most legal analysts expecting that this case will simply, whatever the court decides, that it'll apply pretty much specifically to this case or specifically to Georgia, or could this one set a precedent for the rest of the country?
Well, that depends on what the decision is. I think that if the court finds in favor of Mr. Foster that there was purposeful discrimination, that it won't necessarily have a far-reaching effect, because most cases do not have this kind of demonstrable evidence of purposeful discrimination during jury selection. Now, if the court decides that there wasn't purposeful discrimination here, then I think that would have enormous negative reverberations around the country.
Sarah Turberville is a senior counsel with the Nonpartisan Constitution Project, which studies death penalty cases like that of Timothy Foster, the Georgia death row inmate whose appeal is now going to the U.S. Supreme Court. Ms. Turberville, thanks so much for being with us. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you again.